This is Wikipedia Weekly, episode 48, a special interview with Jimmy Wales, Chairman Emeritus of the Wikimedia Foundation.
I'm your host, Liam White, coming from Sydney, Australia, known as User Witty Llama on the English Wikipedia.
I'm Andrew Lee, also known as User Fuzzheado on the English Wikipedia, coming to you from Beijing, China.
In this wide-ranging interview, Jimmy joins Wikipedia Weekly for the third time, this time from his new place in New York, to discuss a wide range of topics. Later on in the conversation, we talk about the role of chapters, what Ayn Rand and Friedrich Hayek have to do with neutral point of view, corporate and government use of wikis, the value of our edit histories to the future's historians, how Apple Incorporated licensed our trademark, a debate with Andrew Keen, how to deal with biographies of living people, deleting vandalism from our logs permanently, perhaps an ArbCom for content matters, and Wikia search. But first, we started by asking Jimmy to comment on the recently announced controversial changes to the Foundation board structure.
Well, I think it's really great. And so I'm a little confused by some of the furor on the mailing list. I think, in my opinion, a part of what happened was, in the way it was presented, it was that in the original announcement it said something to the effect of, there'll be three community members elected by you, the community, and then two by the chapters, and then so on and so on, where it sort of indicated that the chapter, that somehow the chapters aren't part of the community. And at least my view when this proposal was presented was that, this is like a different mechanism for trying to acknowledge and formalize the way that we have community involvement. And, through the chapters is something that I feel is something that we should strengthen. The chapter system seems to be working well, and it seems like a good pathway for people to get more involved in the kinds of things that we need people involved in. So for me, I thought, this is great. This is like a way to get... It's an adaptation of how the community is involved. And unfortunately, a lot of people seem to have been interpreting it as, now the community's losing control or losing seats. And I just think that's sort of an odd way of looking at it.
The way the press release put it, and this is from the Wikimedia blog written by Jay Walsh on Saturday, it said that some of the significant elements of the restructure, point one, there are now four specific expert seats. Two, a community founder seat has been established. Three, the chapters can now select two seats as well. And four, with three community elected, that brings a total of 10 seats. It seemed that there was... from my mind, three specific complaints. One was one you already raised, that it was people reading it like the community had lost power. Two, that it was sort of landed on the community without anyone knowing about it beforehand. So it looked like that the board was restructuring it to redefine community without actually asking the community. And three, that the chapters... how those seats would be elected is left undefined.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess I addressed the first point. For the second point, I think it's pretty obvious to say, yeah, actually, that's a bit of a fiasco. On the other hand, I am quite sympathetic to Florence's point that it can be quite difficult for the board to get feedback from the community, simply because we, lots of things get discussed by lots of different people in lots of different places, and a lot of the feedback that we do get is from some particular very noisy people who, I think it's fairly clear, don't really represent the community. They just represent people who are going to complain no matter what we do, and that includes a pretty small number of people, but that is one of the difficulties. I mean, if you can imagine trying to figure out, okay, what does the community want, wow, that's a really tough one. And, you know, so I'm sympathetic to that point that Florence had made to a very strong degree. On the other hand, clearly this is a pretty significant move to say, okay, well, look, we're going to actually recognize the chapters in a much stronger way than we have in the past as being, you know, one of the major avenues for community participation. And that could have been discussed ahead of time. So speaking only for myself, I thought, wow, this is great. People are going to love this. So it didn't even occur to me that this would be even remotely controversial. And then the third point that you made was relating, I've forgotten what it was.
It was about how the two chapter seats would be elected. For example...
Right. Yeah.
I'm
so
from
actually,
the Australian...
Exactly. Yeah. So we did have quite a discussion about this in the board meeting, and basically came to no particular conclusions. I think that the real feeling is this is a really complicated problem. We have chapters all over the world in various states of activity, I guess the German chapter would be considered the oldest and the foremost in terms of being organized and functioning as an ongoing entity. They have a paid CEO, and they're always doing different things and so forth.
And now they have a printed edition.
A printed edition, right? They've done different kinds of things like that in the past. The direct media DVD arrangement was arranged by them, and so that's an excellent case of, okay, look, this is actually what we would really love to see, is organizations like this all over, pursuing their agenda independently but consistently with the overall goals of Wikimedia Foundation. So that's a really great structure. We have other chapters that are just formed. We have older chapters that have become somewhat inactive. And then there are questions. I mean, one of the most obvious questions that we would have is, the English Wikipedia is, the largest project and the most prominent. And therefore tends to have a very strong impact on, wiki-style elections that we've had in the past where editors are electing, but is not as likely to have a direct influence, at least under the current setup with chapters, simply because there's only one chapter, the UK chapter, which is by no means as... is there an Australian chapter?
Yes.
There is now.
Oh, good.
It's very...
Well,
it's. We just started about 2 weeks ago, and we are currently talking to the Australian Corporations Commission.
Excellent. So, in this case, you've got two English chapters, but one just barely formed, and the UK chapter is really not to anything like, as systematically organized yet as the German chapter, although I think they're coming along. And then in the U.S., there are no chapters at all. And so, if you're a, what does that mean for you? If you are a, if you're living in the U.S. and you're not a part of a chapter, but you're a part of a local group that plays some of the roles that a chapter traditionally does, and you're interested in having a voice in the governance of the foundation, at least at the moment, it's not at all obvious what that means exactly. There are a ton of interesting questions that pop up about these kinds of things. For example, it's quite possible for anyone, as far as I understand it, to join the German chapter. You don't actually have to be in Germany. You don't actually have to speak German, although I suppose you might have a little trouble with the, filling out the form or what have you. But, in fact, so what does that mean? How does this all work? And then... other interesting questions that I would immediately bring up would be to say, well, the chapters are going to get together in some fashion, but how does it work? One vote per chapter? Or, votes depending proportionally on the number of members that a chapter has, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all kinds of interesting questions that pop up, and I don't think that anyone yet has really got a good answer to that. But I also don't think that those are intractable problems. I think they're just things that have to be thought through, discussed thoughtfully, and really worked out, so that we have some kind of, you know, plan going forward, so that we have a method by which people all over the world can join a local organization, or the nearest local organization that they can, or perhaps an organization far away that's somehow culturally or linguistically relevant to them. And then from that point, have community representation in that fashion.
So going back to what you were saying, that you said it was a bit of a fiasco the way it was launched, this new system. What do you say that to people who would suggest that the board is in a bit of a siege mentality towards the community, that they didn't even talk about this beforehand?
I think that's complete nonsense. I think that there are certain people who like to put forward that sort of view, but it doesn't reflect anything that I've seen at the board level regarding the community. It doesn't ring true to me. It doesn't reflect anyone's comments, any thoughts that anyone was having about this. So I'm not even sure what siege mentality would mean in this context.
Yeah, I think the there seems to be a rift right now, and I think probably on the mailing lists it's trying to be worked out in terms of the board saying, you know, well, yeah, but the foundation and these other lists are very noisy. We pretty much had a sense of what would be acceptable to the community from many, many conversations on the list. We didn't necessarily need a explicit, here's what we're doing, we solicit your feedback, and then the community probably wanted something closer to that. Do you see that as how things are shaked out and on the mailing list right now?
Well, I would say that's exactly what we're seeing being discussed, and I will, jump to Florence's defense in the sense that, you know, as she's pointed out, she's many times posted concepts and gotten basically no feedback, right, or very minimal feedback, and so it's a little frustrating to realize that, you know, sometimes that when you try, you get nothing back, and sometimes you just say, okay, well, we asked around and we talked to a lot of people and this seems like a way to go, and then all of a sudden, you know, well, nobody asked me, and that's a bit of a problem. At the same time, I definitely think that there is there's a fundamental problem here that all of us should think about as a community. And that is, how do we deal with these very complicated issues of communication with lots of different people and lots of different venues, where it's very difficult to say we should privilege one medium over another? How do we deal with those kinds of issues? But also, how do we deal with them in an atmosphere of, our traditional values of assuming good faith? It's a bit painful as a board member to try really hard to stay in touch with lots and lots of people and keep your ear to the ground and talk to lots of people and really try to right. feel things out.
Those communication channels have changed in nature, right? The mailing lists are extremely noisy. IRC is not used as much as before. And
right.
what can yeah. people depend on now, do you think?
I don't know. I still think the mailing lists are a fundamental, they're important. The mailing lists are important because a lot of information and interesting stuff does go on there. As for me, what I would advocate is that we begin to think about getting a little more serious about having a Foundation L mailing list, perhaps a successor to Foundation L, but one that's really a lot more moderated. And I don't mean moderated just in the sense of kicking a handful of very noisy people off. I mean moderated in the sense of really having a place that's low volume, maybe you know, 5 to 10 posts a day. Maybe it's not even a mailing list at that point. Maybe it's more of a daily newsletter almost. But the idea being, you know, trying to have a venue, a place where there is a conversation takes place, but in a controlled volume, so that lots and lots of people could subscribe to it, knowing, okay, look, we're guaranteed this mailing list is going to be 5 to 10 posts a day. I can handle 5 to 10 posts a day. And that somebody's going to edit it, and obviously I wouldn't want to volunteer for that job because you're going to be accused of all kinds of horrible things. But the idea of the way it would be run would be to say, you know, it's really moderation for volume and just keeping the volume down and basically to say, yeah, you know, it's not about keeping out dissenting voices. It's actually about having a controlled way of actually having those dissenting voices really matter for a change.
And I think part of
kill filing people and so forth.
Part of that frustration was seen in the mailing list when Brian moderated it, at least for a few hours. And there was a lot of people who kind of chimed in saying, thank you, thank goodness, I hope this stays forever. Were you kind of surprised to hear that kind of reaction?
No, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are... I think there are a lot of people who are frustrated with the sheer volume. And I mean, one of the problems with an unmoderated list is not just the sheer volume of lots and lots of different people, but that, and all of us, I mean, I can't think of anybody who has been a participant on a mailing list, for any period of time who isn't at some point hasn't been guilty of getting into maybe not a flame war, but just a back and forth exchange with someone that, yes, you find very interesting. And all of a sudden you realize, gee, I actually sent 5 posts today, and the other person sent 5.
Right.
And, gee, there's actually 8 other different groups doing the same thing on the list, and so now we've got this huge volume of stuff. Whereas, you know, if you step back from it and say, actually, it might have been better if we had slowed this dialogue down a bit,
right.
And tried to write out a fuller thought rather than sort of zipping back and forth too quickly. I mean, both modes of communication have value, but I think that there are a lot of people who would say, you know, I would love to be involved. I'd love to keep tabs on what's going on, discussions about the foundation, how it's run, but I just can't really take it. I just can't take the sheer volume of, frankly, of nonsense. Is you know, a lot of it ends up being nonsense. Maybe not even through any of the participants' faults, but just because the threads sort of trail off into circularity and things like that.
Right. Maybe one... One other question related to that was the posting, I think, by Angela, who's the chair of the advisory board, saying that she was not consulted as much as she'd like by the board. And I guess in this particular case, some people expressed maybe the board should have talked to people on the advisory board who have a lot of experience with governance in nonprofits. What do you think about that? Did that ever come up in the board? And do you think the board maybe should have consulted the advisory board?
Well, speaking in a very general way, one of the things that we've always wanted is to have an actually functioning advisory board. Mm-hmm. And so that means not just a symbolic... I mean, I'm on a few different advisory boards for organizations, and I've never heard from them again. And a lot of organizations use the advisory board as an honorary kind of position, as sort of a public thank you or a fellow traveler kind of honor. And, you know, that's fine. Organizations do that. But we always thought we really wanted to have a board that is...
an advisory board.
You know, an actually advisory board that actually advises us. Having said that, I mean, I suppose it would be better. I mean, I think it's a difficult thing because... the advisory board is a group of very busy people. We don't want to bother them too much with lots of different stuff. They have many different kinds of expertise, and so some of them would really basically know more than anybody would about these kinds of issues, and some would have more specialized advice based on their past history and things like that. And I would assume that some of the board members talk to some of the advisory board. I mean, we are in communication with various people, but in terms of a formal, here's what we're thinking, please give us advice back, we didn't do that. And I'm not so sure it would have changed anything. I'm not so sure that, I suspect most of the advisory board would say something the community would not want to hear, which is, you really need to go out and recruit some very top-end professionals to manage this organization like the, multinational charity with a global brand that it is. And that's part of the answer that I think a lot of people in the community are very uncomfortable with. Whereas the board's answer has always been to say, look, we do understand and acknowledge we need those kinds of people. We need that kind of expertise on the board so that we can really get people involved in consulting and advising us about important, complicated issues. But at the same time, we have this really strong commitment to say, look, we come from this community. We're part of this community. We never want to lose that. And so we really want to keep this general idea that, at least a majority and preferably, everyone on the board, if possible, should be someone from the community.
Right.
And that just, it isn't always possible. We've looked around and waited and hoped for a long time. And in terms of, the treasurer's seat, we just realized, actually, we really need to fulfill our fiduciary responsibilities. We really need to get somebody very, very experienced and very, very good to come in and really bring in an expertise level. And it doesn't really matter, if what you're doing is directly overseeing the books and the procedures around money and things like that. It doesn't really matter if you, if you know the difference between a square bracket and a curly brace, as a wiki editor. But for other things, I think it does matter. So
right. Oh, maybe that's a good question that you that we could ask you is, how did you discover the candidate for treasurer for the board?
Well, I didn't have anything to do with it.
Oh, okay.
So I'm probably not the right person to ask. Let me think if I can remember. I mean, there were a lot of emails about it. Basically, there was a search process and an advertisement. And
this is Stuart West of Yahoo, right?
Yeah, Stuart West of Yahoo, yeah. So there was an advertisement. Sue Gardner put an ad in various places, as I understand. I don't remember the details. But there was a whole slew of candidates which were then reviewed and vetted by Sue and Mike and probably Florence. And then once we got it narrowed down, that was when the rest of the board got really serious at saying, okay, look, we've got these three candidates who we met with at the board meeting. And so one morning at the board meeting, we had interviews with all three of them. And, we had their all the information about them there and their background, and we asked them questions about this, that, and the other, and made a decision. And so in terms of how they found these candidates in the first place, I'm not really completely clear on the details.
Right. And maybe just one historical note. I think it was interesting when you're talking about community and what would be satisfactory to the community. A lot of listeners might be interested that the foundation was originally started as a membership organization, and that changed in the bylaws at some point. Could you provide some insight into, how the foundation was conceptualized first as a membership organization and how that changed to what it is now?
Well, yes. Yeah, so I would say in terms of the overall philosophical concept of, what I envisioned originally, I think we're now, particularly with this last move, we're actually moving in that direction, it's really hearkening back to what I originally had in mind in the sense that we have different kinds of stakeholders in the community who need to have a certain voice. And so the chapters ends up being this mechanism whereby we have people who are involved in doing things that may or may not be directly editing, although I suppose almost all chapter members are also editors. And then we have people who are just editing the wiki, and that's a part of, that's their involvement, and they really don't want to get involved in chapter business or foundation business, and that's fine. And so, we're still in a situation where you know, a significant chunk of the board, and in this case it's half the board currently, half the board is in some manner selected by the community. And then we have, you know, other seats that are not. And that's very much what we had originally.
Right.
The technical change from a membership organization to a non-membership organization, that's something you would really have to talk to a Florida lawyer about. I mean, Brad Patrick and I had discussed about it, but I'm not an expert. It's really it's a technical change that had some, it was recommended to us. But it's not like we went from, by Brad.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the actual change, you know, that technicality meant very little anyway. So it didn't really change anything.
So how would you see the prospect for an American chapter, a U.S.-based chapter, given that there's such a high percentage of editors and community members coming from America and that the foundation itself is based there? Is that a likely prospect, and that would that undermine the reason for having these chapter positions on the board in the first place?
No, I mean, for me, I think it's absolutely a good idea to have U.S.-based chapters. Certainly, I don't think it makes sense to have
chapters.
A single U.S. chapter. The reason I wouldn't say have a single U.S. chapter is that, you know, the U.S. is quite geographically large and very spread out. And so there are local groups who meet regularly in San Francisco, is getting to be a very active group now. Boston, people meet up in Boston, New York, in different places. And they're local groups, and they do local things. And that's very similar to, you know, just as you would, it would make sense to have a chapter in, you know, in Amsterdam and another chapter in I mean, I'm sorry, in
so,
the
so you don't see chapters chapter as being necessarily, sorry, you don't see chapters as being necessarily nationally based. They can be of any size.
Right. No. Yeah. I mean, I think that around the world, the context will be different for different people for different reasons, and I think that we can
right.
we can recognize that and say it makes coherent sense to have a German chapter and a Swiss chapter because the culture and the things that they're doing and things like that make sense, and I think it makes sense to say, well, also have a Los Angeles chapter and a New York chapter. That makes sense. Certainly, having a single U.S. chapter, it ends up being a very sort of odd sort of organization because chapters really are about people getting together in person and meeting. And, you know, Germany
it's interesting
is
that
approximately the same size as Montana, right? So it's a very different thing. There are other reasons to have chapters, right, having to do with you know, having a legal entity that can license the trademark to do different kinds of business deals and things like that, those kinds of things might not apply in the U.S. context. Maybe we don't need that for that reason, but that's for me, that's not what the soul or the spirit of a chapter is about.
Sure.
The chapters aren't just sort of business
sure.
affiliates. They're really community organizations.
Could we move on to a different tack completely? Before you came on, Fuzzy and I were talking about the academic origins of Wikipedia and the foundation by, therefore, and we were talking about how you and Tim Schell and Larry Sanger met, I believe, on an objectivist mailing list, that is, a mailing list talking about the philosophy of Ayn Rand. I was wondering if you could talk about how much Randian philosophy has influenced Wikipedia, your conception of it, or was it just happened to be a place where you met and that had really nothing to do with it?
well, I think that's a big question. I would say that there are certain elements of ideas that I have that it would be very difficult to separate out. On the other hand, I'm always very careful in talking about this because It would be a very easy and very false notion for people to say, oh, you know, Wikipedia takes this position on this topic because Jimmy Wales likes Ayn Rand, which for anybody inside the project who know how we work, that's obviously nonsense, but it's always a criticism that I'm concerned about. I mean, one of the things that I was really very keen on from the very beginning of Wikipedia is to say, look, this really, it's not appropriate that I should try to structure Wikipedia so that it reflects my view of the world.
But the neutral point of view editing style that we have adopted as one of the core principles of Wikipedia seems to have a lot to do with objectivist philosophy, that is an unbiased view of reality to make decisions. So is that by chance?
Well, see, what's interesting is I would argue that, yes, of course, that is exactly right. On the other hand, I was just recently on one of the mailing lists, Snow Spinner, was really writing some great stuff, basically arguing that, that Wikipedia is I'm putting words into his mouth that he might not exactly agree with. He made a very nuanced statement, but that Wikipedia, you know, reflects the best in postmodernist thinking and modern critical theory, which is, well, quite a different view from mine. So I think it's a little bit tricky to say that. I mean, certainly, the idea that we should focus on the facts of reality, I think, is something that I very much believe in. On the other hand, much of Wikipedia focuses on, which facts of reality? Well, they tend to be the facts that are facts about what other people have said. In other words, we're looking for reliable sources and things like that. And so,
that Wikipedia sort of outsources truth.
Outsources truth. I kind of like that. Yeah. I mean, there's a saying that sometimes is said, and I don't much care for it, but it's been around for a long time, which is verifiability, not truth. And the problem that I have with that is it sort of suggests that we don't care about the truth. We only care about some sort of artificial game of verifiability. What I would say is that we care about, verifiability and truth. In other words, the verifiable truth, things that people of very divergent views can look at and agree. We may not agree what happened on that day, but we can certainly agree that what the New York Times said about it. That's a lot easier to agree on. And it's not that we don't care what the truth is, it's that we care to sort of write down the truths that we can all agree on. I don't know. I mean, I think one of the whole concept of neutral point of view, as I, originally envisioned it, was this idea of a social concept for helping people to get along and to sort of avoid or sidestep a lot of philosophical debates. And someone who believes that that truth is socially constructed, and somebody who believes that truth is corresponds to the facts of reality, well, they can still work together, and they can sort of, agree
so
to that
neutral point of view is
them.
Neutral point of view is not, in your mind, the same thing as objectivity. It's more like a mechanism for building consensus.
I would say yes. Yes, something like that.
Okay. The other half of Ayn Rand's philosophy that seems to be quite contradictory to the practice of Wikipedia is her complete denial of altruism. I would like to think that I edit Wikipedia and am involved in this project for altruistic means, for the good of humanity. And that seems to be what the mission statement of the foundation is. Why does that seem to be so contradictory to what she was arguing?
I think a big part of this is that people don't have a really deep understanding of her philosophy and her ideas, and so
true.
A lot of arguments or discussions about altruism versus self-interest end up going in sort of confusing circles because of terminological difficulties.
How does she define altruism?
Taking actions that are contrary to your self-interest. One of the things you can say is, well, if you're doing something, one of the things that makes you happy about it is that it's, good for humanity, it's good for the world, it's good for everyone. One of the first questions I would have is, well, do you think that things being better for all of humanity is somehow contrary to your interests? I don't think so. And then if you went on to say, yeah, but I edit Wikipedia to the point that it's actually self-destructive, right? I'm actually doing it, and I'm being self-destructive. I'm actually wrecking my own life for the good of the planet. I would say, you know what? It's really not your job to do that, and you really should relax.
It's quite a thick definition of altruism. It's not just doing something that's nice, but it's doing something that's nice that is actually self-harming.
Yeah, it's a technical definition that would make a distinction between benevolence and altruism. And it comes from, the word was coined by Comte, and that would be his original definition. The point is, I think for a huge range of human activities, there's no really strong reason to take a zero-sum view of the world and say, ooh, am I doing this for myself or am I doing it for other people? For the most part, those things are very much in harmony, that there is actually a huge amount of compatibility of interests amongst the different people. And so, when people are working in Wikipedia, they're doing it, because one reason is it makes the world a better place. Another reason is it's fun and you get to meet interesting people and you get to work on, an intellectual project that makes your brain work. And, there's a lot of good stuff about that. And so I think in most cases, this excessive concern to look for, are you doing this for yourself or are you doing it for others is kind of misplaced. Hopefully, whenever I do something good for a friend or for a stranger, then hopefully that in some way is productive or positive for my own life as well.
Another article that recently came out actually, not recently at all. Reason Online, the neutrality of this article is disputed by Catherine Manger Ward in 2006. It is the only place that I can find that says that you are a fan of Friedrich Hayek, which seems to carry similar sentiments. Where did that come from? That seems to be completely the only source that I can find that says that. And having now read the article on Wikipedia about Hayek, the ideas of spontaneous order and dispersed knowledge seem to be quite relevant, but that no one else has taken up that line.
So what's interesting is I would say take a look at there's an article that is virtually available on the web for free. Published in 1945, so I don't think it's in the public domain, but I don't know, it's on the web anyway. But it's called The Use of Knowledge in Society, and it's by Hayek, and it's from American Economic Review, 1945. And in this article, so this article appeared as a part of an ongoing debate that was going on within economics at that time about the question of which is more efficient, a centrally planned economy or an economy that's directed by a price system, a price mechanism. And
because
that
he's
was,
an economist. He's an economist. He's not a philosopher.
Yeah, but he was a very philosophical economist. So, well, I mean that literally. I mean, he's not sort of the modern type of mathematical economist doing whatever. He was, you know, in the old tradition of, words and you know, thinking about society and knowledge and things like this. Anyway, he makes this argument that it basically he points out that, well, one of the key factors in figuring out whether an economic system is going to actually produce stuff that people want is information. And so what he suggests is that there's a real question, and it's the question, the core question of a centrally planned economy versus a price system, which is more efficient, to communicate all the information inward to a central authority, which will then collect all the information and make a decision, or is it more useful to push the decision making out to the endpoints where the knowledge already is, and let the decision making go on out at the endpoints? So you can immediately see the analogy between that and sort of a Britannica model versus a Wikipedia model. In other words, do we try to gather all the world's knowledge into a temple with a lot of hype and figure out the right things and write them down and distribute it, or do we push the decision making about what goes into the article out to the endpoints, out to all kinds of people who might have very specialized local knowledge?
Certainly, that's what we definitely do.
Yeah, so there is a very strong analogy. Yeah,
he was saying that for the ends, that means for the ends of efficiency. And we're hardly efficient in the way we write articles. And I love it for that, but that's not why
so
we do distributed article editing.
That's right, but I mean, if you think about, if you say we're not efficient, then certainly we all know, as Wikipedians, what a, shocking, unholy mess it can be at times, and a rather long and tedious process. On the other hand, isn't this very similar to the idea of, in a market economy, you can say, well, gosh, it's so inefficient with all of this running about behaviors, and if we just sort of, made a decision that we would just have a central planner figure out everything for us, wouldn't we save a lot of effort? At the same time, when we look at the end result, it's very difficult to look at what has been accomplished by the Wikipedia community in the past 7 years and call it inefficient. I mean, it's staggeringly fast how we have gathered this much decent quality information in all these different languages. I mean, you can't even imagine a traditional system doing this for less than billions of dollars, and so it actually ends up being pretty efficient. And the inefficiencies that we see are more than overcome by the efficiencies of sort of making it super easy for anybody who knows something to come and add it very quickly. There's a lot of wiggling around after that.
Just imagine how much more we would have done if everyone had turned off their TV for an extra hour a day.
Well, did you see this article?
Yes.
I haven't actually read the article. I heard all the buzz about it, a unit of measure, one Wikipedia and television and so forth. I think it's very interesting.
The Clay Shirky article, is that right?
The Clay Shirky article, yeah. It's right. Exactly. I just thought it was a very cool idea, and I need to go and really study exactly what he said, but I'm just... The glimpse I got today of the idea I thought was very, very cool. And it is interesting to me to think about, the not just Wikipedia, but let's think a little more broadly, but the rise of this completely new medium for intellectual hobbyists to do stuff in and to produce things. It means that a certain percentage of our leisure time, which we would have otherwise spent doing something non-productive, we may spend it doing something productive just because it's fun and we like it and it's interesting. And I think there's tons and tons of that going on, but it's probably only going to increase. I mean, and because we can all publish it now on the internet, so I'm thinking of things like you know, video. You know, how many people, you know, in the past would get interested in filmmaking and movies and things like that, and maybe pursue it in an isolated fashion all by themselves, but who now can join who knows what online community, maybe YouTube or maybe more artistic type communities, or, you know, documentary filmmaking communities, people discussing and debating ideas and meeting friends and deciding to work together on projects and things like that. It's really...
It certainly changes the definition of author and reader. If you can now be an active participant in the text that you're reading or the movie that you're watching, it breaks down that barrier between who gets to control the meaning of a text.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a really fascinating, it's a fascinating change. I mean, just to think about, you know, that when you're reading something, you don't have to consider it as, you know, handed down from on high. You can actually participate in it. And, well, you might get reverted, but you can try to participate anyway. And if you do something useful, probably it'll stick around. And yeah, it's a fascinating thing. And I think it's all still so new that, you know, we haven't really had time yet to reflect on what it all means in the long run. I mean, it's a pretty radical break with the past in that sense.
All right. Just one quick follow-up on the Hayek angle, which I thought was quite interesting, because a lot of Hayek's writings have been picked up by the field of knowledge management in the business sector, you know, in terms of tacit knowledge and how corporations get knowledge at the leaves of their organization to become more institutional knowledge. And I guess the big question is, I always get, is what is Wikipedia's impact or Wikipedia's success? What is it meant for companies? I mean, what should companies be looking at, and has Wikipedia's models really influenced the types of things that companies have been trying to do with internal wikis or other type of ways of getting tacit knowledge from their employees into the enterprise? Do you know much about that, or have you met people in your talks around the world about how this is working?
Yeah, I mean, I don't consider myself an expert in that area, but, you know, of course, know people who are in that world, and I've had a lot of talks with them, and then also I meet, you know, people from companies in my travels and when I'm speaking, either, you know, all the way from, you know, sort of everyday people who are working in the company wiki to, you know, CIOs who are thinking about wikis and thinking about what it means for their organizations and things like that. So, I mean, I guess the main thing I would say is that there's no question that Wikipedia itself has had an enormous impact on the way people think about this question inside the enterprise and how to get that kind of knowledge and document it. Mm-hmm. Whether that's led to radical transformation in the way people are actually doing things inside companies, I think it's a little harder to say. There's no question that everybody's thinking about it. Everybody's talking about it. And I actually think that there is this very strong influence of Wikipedia on this idea that, gee, actually, you know, inside the company, if we just had a place people could easily write stuff down and not worry too much as we used to worry about, you know, who controls what and who's allowed to touch what and sort of complex knowledge management systems, but just let go of all that stuff and just let people start writing down and doing whatever it is that they find useful. And I think, you know, the things that I have seen inside companies is that often, you know, like really good stuff gets done, you know, across departments in very ad hoc ways. Sometimes I've seen people do things like they organize, you know, a monthly lunch, and invite people from other departments so they can sort of get to know people in other areas. And they just do it all on the wiki, the same way a bunch of Wikipedians would. You know, they sort of wiki votes about where to eat and where to go, and somebody changes it and reverses it. All that good stuff. But what actually ends up happening is that it's such a flexible system that people find that more more appealing for doing a lot of ad hoc collaboration, even on figuring out where to have the interdepartmental lunch, than to use a more traditional scheduling system, which is clearly superior in a lot of sort of sane ways. On a group calendaring system where you can see who's available and who's busy and send out invites and people can accept them and it adds it to their calendar. All that kind of stuff is designed to do that, and yet people often abandon that and just find that the very free-flowing style of the wiki works better. So I think that kind of stuff
one of the
is
best
very
examples.
But I don't.
Mm-hmm. One of the best examples I saw of one of the best examples I saw, or I haven't seen because it's secret, and intentionally so, was Intellipedia, which a little bit of news got out about it a few years ago that the American Secret Services have a cross-institutional wiki, and maybe it's run on MediaWiki for all we know, where they can share information across departments, and it's different articles are locked depending on the level of secrecy, which is it goes against our idea of radical transparency, but it certainly takes up what you were saying before about the cross-departmental information that happens ad hoc can be allowed. It's possible this way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's known publicly. I don't know anything secret at all, so I can just say that right up front. I think it was announced. I think they are using MediaWiki. I think that's known. And I talked to some people who are involved in that project. When they were initially talking about it and thinking about it, I talked to them, and they gave this example of, in certain cases, in the run up to the war in Iraq, they thought they had a piece of information they thought had been verified 7 different ways. Upon further analysis after the fact, and it turned out to be completely wrong, they discovered that it was confirmed in one way only, and that it came through 7 different channels. And nobody had actually sat down and put all these pieces together. And they really felt like, some of the information sharing procedures that they were using were just too rigid, too archaic, an agent out in the field makes a report, it gets written up, it gets read by an analyst and consolidated into another report and passed up the chain. Lots of errors creep into the process because people aren't able to see all the different pieces of the puzzle, whereas if they could just, hop on the wiki, somebody would say, hey, actually, look, this is supposedly confirmed 7 different ways, but look, at least these 3 I just happen to know are the same. That's the same guy that these 3 different people talk to. And then somebody else turns in and goes, well, those 2 are the same as this. And pretty soon, it sort of starts to unravel and people say, oh, actually, look, we don't really have that much information here. We thought we did, but we don't.
You can just see them having citation needed and sock puppets in Intellipedia.
Exactly. Well, and that kind of thing, I actually think, something like citation needed, where, inside any organization, something like that could make a lot of sense for somebody to be able to say, in a polite way, this is written here, but is this really right?
Says who?
Didn't somebody look at this? Yeah, says who. And so I'm going to mark it. And then everybody else who comes along and reads it will at least know that there's a concern, and maybe somebody will come along and say, oh, actually, I know. I know. This is correct, and here's the proof. Or somebody else will say, wow, good thing you pointed that out, because I actually took a couple minutes and checked my records, and it was wrong. So, I think it's a good thing. It's kind of a fun case to imagine, intelligence agencies trying to do this sort of thing. But I think it's true across lots of organizations that as humans living on this planet, we're all much better off whenever people are making decisions based on better information rather than worse. It's pretty much advantageous to have good information when you're making decisions. So.
We've talked about the value of the wiki model to businesses and organizations now. What do you think about the value of Wikipedia itself or the MediaWiki projects writ large, to the historians and researchers and linguists and sociologists of the future?
Oh, I think it's going to be fascinating. I actually suspect there's some really neat stories to be told in the already existing body of knowledge in Wikipedia. So if we go back and we look at, you know, what people believed, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, there's all sorts of goofy stuff that we can really poke fun at, you know, and really laugh at how barbaric they were back then. I believe that, you know, fast forward another 100 years and we probably believe some pretty outlandish stuff today that we don't even question, that haven't figured out yet. New evidence will come to light and we'll say, holy smokes, what were we thinking? And there are probably some interesting cases of that already. One that I think is probably in there, but it's a little bit too politically charged, and it'd be hard to have a neutral analysis of it because too many people would want to analyze it with a particular axe to grind. But I think the question, the simple factual question of, are there weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? And take a look at what Wikipedia thought about that question and how that changed over time after the invasion of Iraq and hunting around and nothing was found. Because I think, but I don't know, and of course I'm just one person who may have my own biases, and I certainly didn't have access to a lot of information, just what I read in the papers, but I think that there was a time beforehand where a person could quite legitimately and seriously hold the position that, yes, I'm opposed to the war in Iraq, even though clearly it seems pretty obvious that they have weapons of mass destruction because, the information certainly would lead us to believe that. And now that view has changed, and I think that's really interesting to say, go back and look at what was the general consensus view of the general public, where was dissent being expressed, and was it accurate dissent or was it sort of bogus dissent that by sheer luck turned out to be right in the end? All of those kinds of things I think are really interesting when we have a situation where a view that was once at least a reasonable view, which is to say, well, I think probably they have weapons of mass destruction, then with further evidence became a fairly unreasonable view to hold.
Can I give you two examples?
Sure.
For that very reason, at the Iraq Museum International homepage, put up by it's at BaghdadMuseum.org, their editor has put up a mirror or a copy of the Muhammad Cartoons debate talk page, the entire arc of the talk page in two or three different zip files for future historians to look at the debate at the time.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
And secondly, apparently I can't cite this, so there's put a citation needed tag next to this, but apparently one of the best ways we know currently how Latin was pronounced at the time, and this is one of my favorite examples, was by looking at the graffiti on the walls of Pompeii, because it was never cleaned off because they were in a bit of a hurry at the time, we can now look at the spelling mistakes that were made in the graffiti at the time, and that gives an idea as to how those words were pronounced, because spelling mistakes are generally made phonetically.
Yes.
And that's a really important source. And I think that's possibly a value of the dictionaries in 1,000 years' time will look back at this archaic language, English, and see how it was used in the real world as opposed to in journals or as opposed to in published books by looking at the vandalism, by looking at the things that got removed just as much as the things that stayed.
Oh, I think that's actually right. And actually, I think there's some interesting work that could be done right now. I have some ideas that are probably more cute than useful, but hey, cute ideas are good too. One of my
ideas
cute
are free.
Ideas are free. Yes, that's right. One of my ideas would be to take a look at, and I know there are some measures that have been worked out of metrics of formality of language. And it would be interesting to me to see what, I don't know anything about those measures or how that's measured, but to compare the use of language on the article pages versus the talk pages. And at least intuitively, it seems obvious to me that at Wikipedia, in the article space, there is a certain house style that tends to be a pretty clean, formal, international English, and that on the talk pages, it's much more conversational. It's much more informal and conversational. And I think that's kind of, fun. And then my other cute idea, and I really, really want someone to do this, so I'm probably talking to exactly the right audience for somebody to get excited by this goofy idea, which is just a lot of fun. But I want to see, you've probably seen, and I haven't looked at it in years, and I assume it didn't get, destroyed at some point, but the Gorilla UK spelling campaign, there's a page somewhere on Meta. It's a humorous page about how to fix all the American spellings, and somebody made, of course, the counterpart page, the Gorilla American Spelling Campaign, and so forth. One of the things that's really interesting to me would be to take a look and see by hour of the day the percentage, sort of grasp the spellings and other grammatical details for British English versus American English, do a normalize it and graph it over a 24-hour period to show what I think you could obviously show is that that when the Americans are asleep, there's a lot more British spellings, and then, around the world, and when the Americans wake up. And if you were really good, and you really had some real details, right, and you really had enough data, you might even be able to find a few Australianisms and notice that they spike when the Australians are up, or some Indian English. And that would be really cool. I mean, I think the most obvious is this sort of American versus, British spellings, but...
That's true for the English Wikipedia, but for the Spanish Wikipedia, they have fights between Portugal and Brazil because Portugal has the history of the language, but Brazil has many more people who actually speak Portuguese in Brazil. So they fight about that. Same thing between Belgium and France, but they're in the same time zone, so that wouldn't work.
I think it would be fun. I think you could make a really cute graph, showing this effect. And I actually played around once with a database dump to try to do this, but I failed miserably because I ran out of time. But and I'm not that good at doing things like that. So probably
To the first person who produces a graph that actually looks like that or can refute that, I offer the Wikipedia Weekly Barn Star of the Year.
Wow, that's nice.
Yeah, wow, well, that much.
You have to do it Jason Calacanis style and give away an iPhone. So I think we got to get Apple as a sponsor for that. How about that?
Well, actually, speaking of which, this is a completely separate point.
I mean, if I can get an iPhone, I might actually try to do it myself.
Yeah.
Apple has integrated Wikipedia in several different places into their advertisements, into their search. If you right-click or Apple-click onto any word, you can look it up in the dictionary or look it up in Wikipedia directly. They've put Wikipedia into a lot of their products. Has there been any approach from the foundation to talk to Apple about sponsorship or donations or something like that? Or the sharing of hardware?
You should ask somebody who actually knows what's going on. there is some kind of a trademark logo agreement with Apple for their use of Wikipedia in the in Leopard, and they actually I know they work with Brian, they actually get a live feed of changes so that they can keep whatever it is they're doing up to date. But it's been, so Brad Patrick actually negotiated that deal, and Brian, I don't know, I'm somehow CC'd on the email sometimes when they have a question for Brian about it. And look at this. I'm actually looking at it right now. I just got Leopard, and look at that. Oh, I just looked up Creative Commons in Wikipedia in Leopard in the dictionary. Cool. So anyway, so there is some kind of an agreement with them, but I don't know the details of what it is.
Okay. Well, can't answer fairer than that.
So, Jimmy, another kind of unrelated question. You recently had you were on a panel with Andrew Keen, is that right?
Yeah, it wasn't a panel. We actually did a debate out in San Francisco. So it was pretty much just the two of us and a moderator sort of leading us back and forth.
How did that go?
It went surprisingly well. I'm just a very friendly person in person, so I don't really get into, like, sort of outrage debates with people. It's just not my style. And I don't fit the stereotype of what he would imagine or wish that I was like. And so since I tend to be quite traditionalist in my own views and tend to be quite, concerned about quality, it's pretty easy to take a lot of what he has to say and just agree with it. So if he says, right, it's really important that people have high quality information that's been carefully reviewed, I say, yes, I agree completely, that's really, really important. And, it'd be a lot easier for him if I was like, saying, whatever, everything's as good as everything else and just write whatever you want, it's fine.
You hug him to death.
Yeah, exactly. And some of the concerns that he raises, right, not all, but some of the complaints that people might have about Wikipedia are actually complaints that we have ourselves as a community about Wikipedia, mm-hmm, and concerns that we,
sure,
have. And I think we have a little bit deeper understanding of why, the solution to this is not to, close the website and all go home, but that the solution, really has to lie in trying to adapt our model, extend our model, look for the weaknesses, not have real knee-jerk pseudo-solutions that don't really solve the problem at hand. All those things that we've traditionally done a good job of, mostly because we're very slow and conservative and move forward carefully with policy changes and things like that. I think those things are something that we understand and we don't always communicate as effectively as we could to the outside world. I think it's really easy for people to come up with examples that are embarrassing and should be embarrassing for us. I have one I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually much more interesting than the debate with Andrew King, which was fine. I mean, it was fine. It was very predictable. For me, what was a lot more interesting and had a lot more impact on me personally was when I was in Tennessee just a few weeks ago, and I was speaking at an event with John Siegenthaler,
right,
Jr., of the famous Siegenthaler incident. He spoke first, and then I spoke, and then Al Gore actually moderated a panel and sat between us. And I forget who made the joke. It might have been Gore or Siegenthaler or me. I forget who made the joke. It was sort of an obvious that, we had to get a Nobel Peace Prize winner to come and sit between us. But in fact, it was also a very collegial discussion. Siegenthaler is a really great guy and, an ardent defender of the First Amendment and all that. And he got up when he gave his speech just before me, and he presented, for the amusement of the audience, and there was a handout, actually, so we all had a paper copy of it. And it was basically a collection of vandalism from the article about Sinbad, the comedian. Recall, there was an incident where Sinbad was
declared dead.
declared dead, and a relative called him, and he made a joke about it. And I've actually talked to Sinbad, and he's, you know, he's a comedian. He's a great guy, and he, you know, he doesn't hate Wikipedia or anything. It's just whatever, you know, it's his job. So right. It's a good way to get a laugh these days. But the truth is, you know, when you see this string of vandalism quoted, right, from the history, extracted line after line after line after line after line, it's really painful to look at. And certainly anyone who came to his presentation who didn't have a good knowledge of Wikipedia would just say, this is clearly rubbish. You know, it's basically people writing some of the most vile, racist insults, homophobic, violent, you know, it's really disgusting stuff, and it's really quite bad. And Siegenthaler's real question was, you know, he understands how Wikipedia works, and, you know, he's definitely not in the camp who would say, you gotta shut this thing down. His basic concern and question was, why do we keep all that stuff in the history? Why do we keep vile insults of an actual person in the history? He was using the example of Sinbad, but I spoke to his wife as well, and he also gave some quotes of things that were in the history of his article, things that his grandchildren have shown him. And his wife, much more than him, was incredibly pained by this. Mm. You could tell she was very, very upset. She had a very difficult time even speaking to me. She did. She's a very, you know, honorable woman, you know, very, very graceful woman. And yet you could see that she felt that this was absolutely beyond the pale and unacceptable that her husband, who had served in the Kennedy administration, you know, a well-known journalist of unimpeachable integrity, has had literally dozens and dozens of really foul remarks said about him, not actually having anything to do with him, but basically they are our trolls and our vandals who are just tweaking our noses and using him as a foil for that. But why do we keep all that in the history? Mm-hmm. And, well, I gave something of an answer, right? And I think we could all give a pretty sort of standard kind of answer. But I actually felt he had a very good question, and I actually think that we should really start to think about, you know, what are some of the mechanisms that we might use so that when we are reverting simple vandalism, and we're not talking about edits that are contentious and need to be a part of the public record of debate, because that's one of the knee-jerk responses people say is, well, we need to have the history of the debates because whatever, whatever, and that's absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if somebody goes into the Sinbad article and adds in a line that says, yeah, but the motherfucker's dead, and is reverted in under a minute, as most of these were, yeah, why don't we keep them? You know, why don't we keep that in history? Why don't we just expunge it on the spot as we're doing vandalism reverse? And we could keep it all, you know, it's deleted revision, so other admins could check it out. There's a lot of reasons. There are a lot of complications because lots of people do vandalism reverts without being admins, so they can't delete revisions. Do we give that power out more freely, et cetera, et cetera? So I don't have the answer, but I do think he poses a really, really strong case for us wanting to take a second look at this, a good hard look at this, and saying, gee, why do we keep all this junk in the history?
Right. So cases of completely obvious vandalism, like poop, four-letter words, just on their own, maybe just strike them and just oversight them, absolutely, and just strike them from the database.
Exactly. Or I mean, I think, I actually discussed with him, you know, that he understood that some revisions from his entry have been deleted. Mm-hmm. He said it concerns him a little bit that there's some over 1,000 anonymous people who can still see it. But he's not so worried about it. Like, he gets it that those people are trusted and whatever, right? It's a small number of people. So I don't think true oversight is necessary so that even admins can't see it. But getting it out of the publicly viewable history, right. Gee, why not, you know?
Right.
And you know, a lot of technical obstacles and social obstacles to thinking about how do you do that while still maintaining – you know, lots of things. I mean, even deleting revisions of vandalism can be problematic right now, because if I go and review someone's edit history and they say to me, you know, Jimbo, I've been persecuted, and look at my edit history, I've done absolutely nothing wrong, and I go and look at it, and if I don't look carefully, gee, the deleted revisions, you know, it's like, I can't see that you did anything bad because somebody deleted all of the horrible, horrible things you did.
Right.
Unless I really dig a little deeper. And, well, that's kind of a problem, and I don't know an easy answer to that. But I think there must be some answers where we can somehow, you know, make it so that we still maintain transparency about people's bad behavior, but at the same time we make it a little less likely that somebody's, you know, going to stumble across something in the history that's really vile.
Right.
Well, what do other encyclopedias and dictionaries of biographies that exist now, printed versions or other online versions, do when they have a biography of someone who doesn't want to be published?
I don't know. I suppose they do pretty much what we do, which is you publish it anyway. And, you know, I mean, for us, I think there really aren't... we are a very special category, right? Because... having a Wikipedia entry about yourself, particularly if you're not a notable person, particularly if the only notability you have is somehow controversy, it's kind of a big deal as compared to being written up in a book somewhere, because it's the number two or three hit in Google for your name. It's available for your enemies to come and vandalize. It's really a different category of problem. That I have a lot more sympathy for than if somebody said, I don't want you to write a newspaper article about me.
Right. I mean, the one thing we were discussing just the other day is there's a lot of strengths of Wikipedia, but its one big problem is coherence. So it's deep, it's wide, it's quick to update, but in terms of giving an article its due space in relation to its importance, that's the real problem of Wikipedia, and that's why you had articles like Brian Pepper's running for two or three pages, obsessing about his physical disfigurement, and as you said, it's just dignity-wise, it was a disgrace to have an article like that in Wikipedia. And something that people were talking about is, well, what if we did have a way in Wikipedia of saying, you know, Brian Pepper's is someone that you may want to look up, but you shouldn't have more than three or four sentences about him, or you should have something limited about him and keep it at that. Is there a way for the community to move to something like that, or do you see a way for policy to form that type of...
As opposed to deleting the article.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that's a really good question. I think it's difficult. I think in many ways, the broad community view about biographies of living persons has matured significantly. Mm-hmm. Over the last couple of years, and a lot of that sort of thing goes on implicitly but imperfectly. And so we have, you know, people in the community who are quite vigilant about certain articles and saying, look, we really need to keep an eye out on this one because there are people who are really, you know, inappropriately obsessing and really in a mode of attacking this person, and it's just really not called for. And what we really need is just a basic biography and just leave it at that. But we don't have a mechanism to formalize that. In other words, and any mechanism like that, well, I shouldn't say any, I should say any mechanism that I've thought of like that, feels pretty alien to our traditions and our values, and kind of difficult to implement. You can imagine a situation where, you know, we... full protect an article, and we say, that's it, that's the Brian Pepper's article, it's done. Everybody take a big step back, and we'll talk about it again in 6 months. Mm-hmm. That actually might not be a bad approach, now that I think about it. I'm just thinking out loud here, because when I deleted the Brian Pepper's article, and that was really a one of those very rare sort of Jimbo declarations, that are also part of our traditions, but I said, you know, where it had been through multiple debates and deletes and undeletes and da 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 da. And I just said, all right, knock it off for a year. Right. A year from now, we'll come back and we'll think about it and talk about it. And then we did a year later, and I guess the decision was made to keep it deleted because the community's view on biographies had moved forward. I wonder what would have happened, and I wonder what would happen now if from time to time we had a procedure whereby the arbitration committee perhaps, or it can't be me because it doesn't scale.
Right.
Probably the arbitration committee isn't the right body. But if we had a mechanism to say, actually, we're gonna full protect this article in this stubbed state for 6 months, and then at that time we'll have a process of review to discuss whether or not it should be expanded. Because I think the thing that you want to always preserve is the possibility that there are changed circumstances. Brian Peppers, may eventually do something.
Gain more notability through some other reason or something.
Through some other thing, right? So I don't know nothing about the guy, but, perhaps he'll write his memoirs about how troubling it has been for him that people attacked him on the internet and becomes the number one New York Times bestseller, and he's on all the TV shows discussing his problems. And if that happens, then it'd be pretty hard to say we can't have an article about it. At that point, it's kind of hard to say this is actually a really stupid internet meme, and that's kind of like all there is to it. So, and so as long as you can always revisit it, I think that's a good thing.
And that's something we were talking about as well. As you said, you want something ArbCom-like, though ArbCom now is all about procedure and behavior. But it seems like there is a sufficient body of articles in this state or that raises this question that there might be a role for some type of ArbCom-like function for content and for articles.
Yeah, so this is an idea that's come up lots and lots of times, and I've actually had a lot of discussions with the ArbCom and ArbCom members over the years, and there's just a huge amount of concern about it, right? What could it turn into? It's one of the really important values of Wikipedia, the value of neutrality, and one of the important safeguards for neutrality is that sort of mutually assured destruction that anyone can edit at any time. And if you take that away, right, you could immediately see certain slippery slopes. So it's one thing to say, yeah, let's have a borderline notability human dignity committee that is going to take a look at some of these really tough biographies and perhaps try and resurrect them in a respectful state and lock it in, and it's not going to be a really open process. It's going to be trusted people in the community. That probably is kind of okay, I think, for most of us. On the other hand, if we say, now let's do the same thing for another contentious area,
right.
Israel-Palestine, or let's do that for global warming, now all of a sudden we've got this enormous political football that isn't just sort of inside wiki politics. Because, the question of Brian Peppers is not it's a wiki political issue, as to how you feel about sort of what are the borderline areas regarding human dignity and biographies and notability and things like that. It's very different because it doesn't really draw a huge amount of interest, except from trolls and things, but it doesn't really, there's legitimate people in the community have different views on this subject, and that's great and interesting, and it's something we can always work with. But it doesn't sort of bring in this sort of broad outside view, and it doesn't carry, I think there's huge risk. I mean, I would be very uncomfortable with a content body that decides certain political issues. I just think that's really risky and really concerning. So I don't know how you draw the line around some of these kinds of things.
Right, and I think that's that concern that makes people not even want to peer down this avenue at all and just leave it the way it is.
Yeah, and that's probably a mistake, right, to say... To jump from, this looks like a problem where maybe some kind of content judgment body would be useful, to, oh my God, it's the final takeover of the liberals or the conservatives or Jimbo and his buddy, you know, the cabal, right? And I think, I mean, I don't think it's that hard to avoid those kinds of things, but I think there is some concern about it. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question. You know, what are some of the innovative ways we could think about having a little more ability for the community to deal with some of these problems?
Right.
I think we should maybe start to wrap this up. I suppose you might want to go to bed at some point in the day.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea, yeah. Actually.
No, yeah.
Perhaps we can finish here. with one last section on what are you doing now? Specifically, how is Wikia Search coming along?
So I'm actually in New York to work with my team on the search project. Actually, since this is a community-oriented broadcast, I probably don't need to say this, but I try to always say this whenever I'm talking about both things in one subject, that Wikia is a completely separate organization and has nothing to do with Wikipedia. So I always want to do that because I get accused of conflict of interest.
Yep.
So what I'm personally working on is I'm here. We're actually pounding away on version 0.2. And basically, when we launched back in January, no, back in December, whenever it was we launched, I'm a stateless protocol, so I never know when I did anything in the past, but when we launched sometime in the past, we had the social networking component of it was written in Java, and well, it was cool and all that, but it didn't really integrate very well with MediaWiki. Parallel to that, our New York team, who run a site called Armchair GM, which is a sports collaborative blog wiki thing. It's based on MediaWiki, and then they created a lot of social tools, so things like friending people and leaving private messages for people and all that stuff. We just released all the social code. We just released open source, I don't know, a month or two ago. I don't remember when. Anyway, that stuff integrates very well with MediaWiki, and so when we had our all-hands meeting earlier this year, we said, well, it's really crazy to have two different social network systems. We really want to have one. So we decided to abandon the Java code and basically redo everything as very tightly integrated with MediaWiki. So that effort is going to come to fruition here in about another month or two. At the same time, on the back-end search side of things, there's been a lot of work going on. Dennis is our Nutch guy, and he's actually just started work on Nutch 2.0. So he's a committer. He's not the head of the Nutch project, but he's a committer. And so he's really beginning a fairly major restructure, and I don't know that much about it. He was just explaining it to me today, and I really need to do my homework to see what it is he's working on. And then Jeremy, who was the founder of Jabber, the you know, instant messaging protocol, the open source, you know, IM thing, he's been doing amazing user interface stuff using Ajaxy stuff. So the ability for people to, with one click, delete URLs, add URLs, annotate URLs. There's a preview mode that's really cool. He's done an amazing job of stuff. And what's actually kind of fun is he's building all this stuff very quickly. Because he's doing it very quickly, he's not building in a lot of controls as to who's allowed to do what and all that. So this is really great for me because it fits my philosophy. So I've been saying to him, you know what? Actually, don't worry about security right now. We're going to open this up and we're going to get inundated with spammers, but I don't care. Like, let's not solve the problems until we actually have it. Let's keep it painfully open at first and just see what happens. So I don't know when we're going to launch. It's probably about another month or two from now that we're going to roll this out. Parts of it are already available publicly. If you look on the mailing list, you can go and find the link to sort of see, because Jeremy likes working kind of live without a net on the on the open web. And then the other thing that we've got right now is that we're still running under a trial index. So we have about, I think currently we're running about 30 million URLs or actually indexed. Obviously, with 30 million URLs, you don't get really good relevance on long tail results. But we're not too worried about that right now. That's not really the focus of our attention. Our focus is to really develop the tools so that it's easy for people in the community to actually come and actually assist in the editorial process. So that's kind of where we stand.
Right. And you're working with another organization on this as well. Is that right?
I'm not sure who you're referring to exactly. We work with several different organizations.
No, there was someone that you were working on with infrastructure and computing power. I can't remember where I saw
it. Oh, yeah. So actually what happened is that we arranged for 1,000 servers to be donated to ISC, which is Paul Bixby's organization.
Mm, right.
And right now there's only a subset of those are actually up and running. The rest are there. He's still building his data center, so he's still got to get more electricity in there. And basically what he wants to do with this stuff is to host a public crawl. So he's going to be hosting for whoever wants to use it, and it's completely open right now for anybody to interact with the API and use it.
Hmm.
But Vic is going to host basically a crawl of the web. So it's going to be very similar to... archive.org obviously has a historical crawl of the web to create their history of everything that goes on the web.
Right.
In this case, the idea is not to create archive.org again. It's not to keep a past history crawl of the web, but to have a live, fresh, updated crawl of the web that anybody can use for experimentation, research, and things like that. And so we're actually managing that for them, and so they're like running the crawl and things like that.
Interesting. So ISC is an Internet Systems Consortium, and I guess the idea is instead of having N search engines doing N crawls of the web, you can kind of have a public crawl that other search engines can query against to kind of be more efficient. Is that right?
Exactly. So. Neat. And in the end, I mean, I think Vixy has a lot of different ideas. I mean, he hosts a lot of free software projects. It's a nonprofit, so he's doing a lot to support, open source and different kinds of projects. He hosts, is it OpenBSD or FreeBSD? He hosts all their stuff for them. And
right.
Several different projects he hosts in his data center. And in the long run, I'm not sure really what he is going to do with 1,000 machines. So that's up to him. Right now, they've been donated, and right now they're sitting there in racks waiting to be turned on. And, we may assist with that, or I don't know yet. We're just sort of cranking away.
Right. All right. Any other questions, Liam?
I think we should probably let him get to sleep.
Yeah. Actually, one last funny comment. Have you ever searched for encyclopedia in Wikia search?
No, I haven't. I'm sure it's embarrassing. What does it say?
It has pretty much everything except Wikipedia.
Well, see, nobody can claim that it's all biased to promote Wikipedia. So, actually, one of the things that we're looking at is, right now with 30 million URLs, and it's also set to a maximum crawl depth of 10, I think. That's the number I was given today, I believe. So basically, Dennis, I guess, fed in, www.wikipedia.org, and it crawled only as deep as 10 links. I don't know. 10 sounds like it could be really deep. I don't know how he measures it. Anyway, but what he told me is that the number of URLs crawled from Wikipedia right now is really quite small. And I said, okay, well, let's fix that.
So. Great. Well, thanks a lot, Jim. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Indeed.
Yep, no problem. All right, good night, guys. Bye-bye.
Okay.